And I'd like, you don't have to address it right now, but I'd like to, maybe the three presidents want to talk about that.
The presidents are attorneys and can speak to that with some authority.
But it scares me. It's a very nervous statement to be used, and I don't want to start us down that path again.
Amen.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yee.
My question is for all the presidents of university, including the three previous ones. I think at a time when we talk about budgets, we want to know if you can carefully examine your structure, the university system as a whole, and in each university, to see if there are any duplication of programs you can consolidate or eliminate. If you can also look into your own university to see if there are any programs that have outlived its usefulness. Take out some programs that you don't need anymore and consolidate programs that duplicate and have a more efficient system. I mean, have you given some thought into this? So I would like you to address this question at the end of your presentation. And the ones, I guess, the previous three presidents can send us memos regarding my question.
Good morning, Senator Chair Beyer, Chair Crow, members of the committee. My name is Dan Bernstein. I'm the president of Portland State University. Based on the investments that that you made in higher education and funding the new budget model in 1999, at Portland State we promised several things. One, that we would serve more students. Second, that we would invest in programs that serve the economy of the region. Third, that we would improve our programs primarily by focusing on faculty salaries, and second, and finally, make investments in our infrastructure. And we're living proof that the budget model actually works. We're now the largest institution in Oregon. We expect our enrollment to reach about 22,000 students this year. We've witnessed growth of about 11% over the last 3 years. We've increased the number of students enrolled in electrical and computer engineering by over 30% over last year. As we look at the anticipated budget cuts, we've established a number of principles that we hope will guide us in those cuts. And a number of those principles are, first, that we expect to maintain student access for Oregon undergraduates in a program of as high quality as possible, with a curriculum that's as diverse and vital as possible as well. Secondly, we expect to continue our investments in engineering, science, and technology, because as a major provider of higher education in the metropolitan region, we are certainly sensitive to the needs of the region, and we are working within the board's declaration that while deferring the top-tier engineering initiative, that 2X is still extremely important, and based on that, we expect to continue major investments in engineering. We also expect to maintain our collaborations with our sister institutions, Oregon Health Sciences University and OGI, leveraging not only our resources but their resources as a way of, again, providing a vital curriculum, as well as continuing to serve some of the particular needs of the high-tech community. Certainly, at as the level of increases rise, and as we get from 6 to 10%, there'll be significant impacts on our university, our ability to provide access, our ability to continue to meet the needs of the region. What we've tried to do is put together a process in place on our campus so that once we are aware of what the final cuts will be, we can actually look at our programs, make some serious decisions. In response to Senator Yee's question, I think in many respects, most of us, most of the institutions in the system have constantly been in the process of looking at our overall programmatic offerings, trying not to have programs that are outdated, trying not to have programs that that duplicate each other. I think one of the major challenges of Oregon institutions, particularly a school like PSU, is that we've been so lean that it's been almost impossible to compete with our sister institutions, not in Oregon, but in particular those institutions around the country that can provide more attractive opportunities to our faculty, more attractive facilities to potential students, to potential faculty, and so on. So with that, I will yield to my colleagues, President Stromeyer and Risser.
Mr. Chair, I just want for you to all of you to point out, because the other presidents didn't get to, but what it means to cut faculty by 20% or whatever it is you have to do if you have to cut at the 10% level. I mean, that I don't know how many faculty members, President Bernstein, you'll have to cut, but I know that there will be substantial cuts in faculty. What does that mean? What does that mean to the quality of the institution, its competitiveness? What does it mean, basically, to student opportunities?
Mr. Chairman, before you answer, may I ask your pleasure? Would you rather that we wait until all three finish or ask one at a time? What is your pleasure?
Well, we are out of time for OUS, and so I guess I would like to answer these questions in writing as much as possible. I have a list. I've kept track of questions that people have asked, and I can make it available to
okay.
the chancellor or to university president so they can answer these questions. So I would prefer to be able to, because we are running short on time.
I would like them to, because we're interested in the consequences of these cuts, and we're likely to have to make them at a rather significant level. And so what are the consequences going to be?
Thank you. Co-chairs Beyer and Trow and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My time is severely truncated, so let me cut right to the chase, if I may. We're here only because all the easy problems have already been solved, and we appreciate the committee's difficulties, and I think you understand why we are speaking the way we do. So let me just touch on maybe 4 points very quickly. I think I can do that in less than 4 minutes. The first of them is that the model that you have adopted, which Chancellor Cox has pointed out has made such a difference to higher education, is based upon increasing student enrollment, making sure that we get enough Oregonians to go have the opportunity to be educated, that they'll be able to face up to the challenges of the 21st century. And we have responded to that which you've asked for us. The University of Oregon is at an all-time record enrollment in full-time equivalent students. It's more than 19,000 students. They have the best GPAs, the highest SAT scores, more Oregonians, and more racial and ethnic diversity than ever before. That's, I think, what you wanted. That's what we've delivered. That's what the students have done because of the enhancements that have been given to higher education, especially over the last 4 years. And we thank you for it. And you can understand the pain with which we appear before you today to face a cutback scenario. But that's the first point that needs to be remembered. It is a student-driven, tuition-driven model. And it's a model that has been successful, and students are voting with their feet to stay here, and in record numbers at the highest grade point averages and the highest achievement levels, they're staying here because they want to be educated here. They need higher education more than ever. The difference now between a student who has only a high school degree and a baccalaureate degree from a college over a lifetime will be $1 million of family income. And that number, ladies and gentlemen, is growing because that's what the knowledge economy of the 21st century dictates. So what we're talking about is not merely good for Oregonians right now, it's good for the state's economic future. And of course, I think we'd add the same, all three of us here, in terms of what it is that a research university climate adds to the economic stability of a state. That's a point with which I'll conclude in just a moment. Our historical experience with cutting budgets has been catastrophic. In the early 1980s, Senator Hannon has referred those two terrible words, financial exigency. Once you declare that in any institution with it, which I'm familiar, you do not recover within a generation. That's different than other sectors of the economy where you simply can add back people. But once a place has a reputation as not being friendly to or supportive of the enterprise of educating its citizens to the highest level, it doesn't get back that reputation, and it won't attract faculty for a very long time. So it's a very, very serious proposition and one that needs to be taken very carefully. To respond very briefly, because the point fits in very well to Senator Yee's question about looking for duplication, we have done so. We actually did it in the early 90s after the passage of Measure 5. We cut 100 programs in higher education. We added back 12. That's a net loss of 88 programs. In the case of the University of Oregon, it was losing one entire college and most of another one. It was losing entire departments. It consolidated all four journalism programs of all the institutions of higher education to just one place. There's only one school of that med, one law school, one school of journalism, one school of music in the entire state system. So I believe that Senator Yee, in good faith, we have been very conscious of the opportunities to look for elimination of any residual duplication, and I believe that that has been done. Two relevant points, and I think I can conclude with them, even though there's much more to say. That is that even the perception of program instability causes the loss of students. And to relate to the question asked by Senator Carter, of course we lost students in the early 90s, from Measure 5 cuts, but they didn't go from higher education four-year colleges to community colleges. To the best of my knowledge, they didn't go anywhere. We lost that cohort of students altogether to a higher education opportunity. And that seems to me just a perception that they couldn't get an education, that if they started out majoring in English, for example, that they couldn't finish, even though every institution offered them that kind of major. The perception among our students led to a net loss of higher education opportunity that was not made up by another sector of post-secondary and education in Oregon, but simply meant a loss of educational opportunity altogether. That's a critical factor to remember. And that is especially accentuated now because our model is so much driven by student tuition. Student tuition pays far more now than state support in all of our institutions. And in my institution, it pays the most of any institutional budget. So what that means is that if we start losing students because of the perception of program instability, we lose revenues again in a downward spiral. There's no stability at the bottom. So it's very, very critical that you know where we think that tip-off point is. And our best estimate is that it's between 5 and 6%. And that without augmentation or giving us the chance to augment our revenues, that you set in motion, if the cuts go beyond that level, something that's very, very serious and is not remediable for a generation. My final point, if I may, is that if you're looking for strategies that sustain the state and looking beyond the crisis mentality with which we're all necessarily infected because of what we're facing, in my view, and I think it's backed by those from outside the state who could not be accused of speaking with self-interest, the best strategy that you have is a strategy of continuing educational opportunity to the best of any student's ability. There's not a state that's going to make it through this recession quickly without having a strong investment in higher education and higher education resources, whether they're at the community college level or at the post-secondary level in our research universities. And so I urge you to be thinking in terms of the long run as to the sustainability of this state, and you can't have it, I think, without that kind of relevance of the higher education investment. Thank you for your patience. I know that there's much more to be said and no time within which to say it. I appreciate the chance to be with you today.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. Senator, so let me, and members of the committee, let me see how efficient I can be in just a few minutes here and make the points that I want to. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Let me speak specifically.
It was losing entire departments. It consolidated all four journalism programs of all the institutions of higher education to just one place. There's only one school of vet med, one law school, one school of journalism, one school of music in the entire state system. So I believe that Senator Yee, in good faith, we have been very conscious of the opportunities to look for elimination of any residual duplication, and I believe that that has been done. Two relevant points, and I think I can conclude with them, even though there's much more to say. That is that even the perception of program instability causes the loss of students. And to relate to the question asked by Senator Carter, of course we lost students in the early 90s from Measure 5 cuts, but they didn't go from higher education four-year colleges to community colleges. To the best of my knowledge, they didn't go anywhere. We lost that cohort of students altogether to a higher education opportunity. That seems to me just a perception that they couldn't get an education, that if they started out majoring in English, for example, that they couldn't finish, even though every institution offered them that kind of major. The perception among our students led to a net loss of higher education opportunity that was not made up by another sector of post-secondary in education in Oregon, but simply meant a loss of educational opportunity altogether. That's a critical factor to remember. And that is especially accentuated now because our model is so much driven by student tuition. Student tuition pays far more now than state support in all of our institutions. And in my institution, it pays the most of any institutional budget. So what that means is that if we start losing students because of the perception of program instability, we lose revenues again in a downward spiral. There's no stability at the bottom. So it's very, very critical that you know where we think that tip-off point is. And our best estimate is that it's between 5 and 6%. And that without augmentation or giving us the chance to augment our revenues, that you set in motion, if the cuts go beyond that level, something that's very, very serious and is not remediable for a generation. And my final point, if I may, is that if you're looking for strategies that sustain the state and looking beyond the crisis mentality with which we're all necessarily infected because of what we're facing, in my view, and I think it's backed by those from outside the state who could not be accused of speaking with self-interest, the best strategy that you have is a strategy of continuing educational opportunity to the best of any student's ability. There's not a state that's going to make it through this recession quickly without having a strong investment in higher education and higher education resources, whether they're at the community college level or at the post-secondary level in our research universities. And so I urge you to be thinking in terms of the long run as to the sustainability of this state, and you can't have it, I think, without that kind of relevance of the higher education investment. I thank you for your patience. I know that there's much more to be said and no time within which to say it. So we appreciate the chance to be with you today.
Thank you, Senator Beyer, Senator. So let me, and members of the committee, let me see how efficient I can be in just a few minutes here and make the points that I want to. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Let me speak specifically about Oregon State just a minute. Oregon State University has grown by more than 4,000 students in the last 5 years. Think about what I just said, 4,000 students in the last 5 years. To answer Senator Yee's question, our requirements are that students have a B average. The incoming high school students this year at Oregon State University had a 3.53, which means that they have an average of A- in their incoming score. That is the highest among all OUS universities, and as far as we know, it's the highest in the history of OUS. So that's access, and that's quality, and that's what's important to us. Let me focus on one other point that Senator Hannan raised, and that is, it is true that if we have obstacles to students who come to our colleges, they will not go to college. But the other implication is that the best students will go out of state. The best students have lots of choices, and so they will go out of state. So it's not just a number of students, but we'll systematically lose the best of our students. Let me organize my points around three topics and do it quickly. First of all, that as you look at the OUS budget, you'll notice that there's a disproportionate cut on the public statewide programs. It's a huge cut in those programs. Let me tell you the economics of that decision. If you look at the economic impact, the direct economic impact of the experimentations and the extension programs, that's $348 million impact of those programs on this state's economy every biennium. If you add that to the impact on the economy, that is, those dollars move through, that's a total of about $600 million a year. And if you add the Sea Grant programs and other programs, the direct impact of these programs on the biennium is $800 million. Think about the size of your shortfall. So these programs in a biennium have a bigger impact than your $720 million shortfall. Point one, engineering. We do talk about 2X, and 2X is certainly important. But when you think about engineering, again, it's the quality of the top tier that makes a difference. That is, new companies are frankly not created by sort of me too ideas or me too technologies. They're the ideas that come from the best students and the best faculty. Our economy will grow in part because current businesses, many of them will grow because we have new industries, and that comes from the top quality. Moreover, in this state, we have a large concentration of high technology in the Portland area, But there are many, many small firms around this state trying to be successful in high technology. They can't recruit nationally or even worldwide. And so having a strong top-tier engineering program in the state helps those small companies around the state. Very, very important point. The last point I'll make has to do with an answer to Senator Byers' question, has to do with the campus at OSU Cascades in Central Oregon. What I can tell you is that there's been lots of confusion in the newspaper about the numbers, but if you look at enrollment, it's exactly on track for our goals in terms of the number of students will be there. I can also tell you that the $7.2 million is what we're spending for that branch campus. That's an enormous investment in terms of returns. That is, think about it. You're essentially getting a four-year college with a COC undergraduate, first 2 years from COCC, second 2 years from the Cascades campus. For $7.2 million, you're essentially getting a four-year college in Central Oregon, a part of the state that's growing rapidly and has an enormous diversity of needs. So it's a huge investment that will bring many, many returns for those dollars. Two last comments. In answer to Senator Yee's question, Oregon State has been involved in the last 3 or 4 months in intensive redesign to look essentially up and down the university to see if, in fact, there aren't better ways to do the things we're doing. So we can look every taxpayer in the state of Oregon in the eye and say every dollar that goes to Oregon State is spent to the best of our ability. Last point I'll make is that college graduates make $20,000 a year on average more than a high school graduate. If you look at the reduction that we are seeing in the shortfall, two-thirds of that comes from a reduction in state income tax receipts. Where does the income tax come from? It comes from earning power of individuals. So the best investment we can make in this state to increase our revenue is, in fact, to increase college graduates. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator
Yee. Mr. Reeser, you said that the admission criteria is about a B average in Oregon State, but what is the dropout rate?
As Chancellor Cox described to you, dropout rates in colleges are difficult to calculate because some students come and stay a long period of time, they start and stop out again. But what we do calculate is a retention rate, and that's the rate at which students stay from year to year, and ours is about 85%, which is about comparable to similar universities.
You mean within a four-year span, 85% of the students graduate from the same university?
No, I mean that's the retention rate from freshman to sophomore, for example. So that's the rate at which students stay from 1 year to the next. Mm-hmm.
But what is the aggregate?
I'm going to give them an opportunity to answer those questions in writing.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the answer in writing.
Sure.
Thank you.
Promptly.
Senator Carno, your soapbox is built. It's
I've been working on my soapbox the last few minutes here, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak on my soapbox. I will be representing over 100,000 people who do not have access, and I've been denied access to higher education for a long, long time. And I would just say that since we've been the fastest growing this state, when you have 100,000 people who pay taxes for higher education, the rest of the part of the state, they often feel like their ox has been gored for a long time. I think having the community work for over 25 years to try to get access to higher education, I would just say that people in this area have sent their children to other higher education institutions in this state for, like I say, 144 years. Those people pay for their children to have housing, board and room, and education. So they're paying double. And I know there's a lot of concern about the branch campus, but I don't think we can talk about the urban and rural split of Oregon and give it lip service without really doing something about fairness. And I guess I would just say that when you have to travel over 100 miles, and many parts of the state have to travel over 100 miles to be able to access to higher education, we need to stop and think, no, this isn't the time to say we can't do this. When are we going to do it in 144 years if we don't do it now? We've had COCHE, which started in 93 when I was in this process with Tom Bartlett. We've had the University Center, and now we have a branch campus, and I hope we'll all think carefully about denying over 100,000 people access to higher education
when we look at what we have to do. Thank you, and I thank you, Senator. Well, you were. Dave Frohnmayer and Paul Risser for the work that they've done in Central Oregon jointly to make it have the programs that we now have available, and appreciate both your work. Thank you very much.
A question for the record, Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
My question is Dr. Risser, and Dr. Bernstein answered the other one I had for him, but how should we balance funding for targeted programs with the need to provide access to Oregonians if the targeting funding for, say, for instance, engineering is reduced? Because I know the investments you've made along those lines. So will you diminish your commitment to improving engineering or, say, nursing, where we have the largest shortage in the history of this state in nursing? And so look at targeted programs of that nature, each one of you, as you look at your campuses, and tell me how can this be done, and at the same time provide Oregonians with basically a bird's-eye view of trying to keep our economy strong.
Thank you. Well, I'll get that answer right now. Does anyone else have questions that they would like to submit in writing to Mr. or Chancellor? And I'm sure he will be very timely in getting a response to us. I've got a list here that I'll provide them that I have kept. I'm sure the staff probably has some list of questions that were asked, and we asked for questions at a later date. Thank you very much. We are running about 50 minutes behind schedule. We will now go to the Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Thank you, committee members, for your...
Thank you.
Thank you, colleagues, for your good work so far this morning and your willingness to sit through a long session, and we've got many more to come.
And thanks for indulging me.
Now, you owe us for that
one. Yeah. Okay.
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
For the record, Cam Price Brawley, the Commissioner of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. This morning I'm going to... I would like to present to the committee an overview of the Community College Workforce Development budget and the 2-10% cuts that the 2-10% reductions and what that equals. And then I have invited three community college presidents to share with you what those impacts would be at the local level. So seeing that you are running a little behind time, I'll talk fast. On page 2 is just a brief picture of the overall agency budget. We do receive $113 million in federal funds for job training and adult basic education, $448,000 for the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, and $467 million for the Community College Support Fund. 98% of this budget is passed through to local entities to deliver either community college services or adult basic skills training or job training.
Are the federal funds that you have there, your $113 million, are any of those in jeopardy by any cuts?
Mr. Chair, yes, indeed, there are some. Congress did pass a rescission for the dislocated worker dollars to the tune of about $110 million last summer. They have not affected that rescission yet because of the September 11th terrorist attack. The Secretary of Labor has held that money and not actually rescinded it. There is currently debate in Congress whether that money will be rescinded at all, but Oregon is about 2% of the total national budget, so we would feel that rescission, but to date it has not been affected. On page 4 of your handouts, This is just a picture to show you where and what counties in the state actually are covered by community college districts. And the box is actually the administrative center, but many of you know that most community colleges have outreach centers throughout their district. So just a picture. The next to page 5 is a detailing of the community college students by county. It's our attempt to take a look at what's our penetration in the market for community college services. Total students enrolled in the 99-2000 year would be the whole number, and then the percentage is what is that of the total population for that county. And I'm going to pick on Lane County as an example. There are 43,139 population in that county, and of that, 13.4% of the county residents access Lane Community College for service. On page 6, just a snapshot for those of you who are not familiar with community colleges and their governance. The department is a distinct state agency. Our job is to distribute the resources to the 17 community colleges. We are a distinct and separate agency from the Department of Education and the university system. At the local level, each college board does have a locally elected board of 7 members, and those college boards have numerous responsibilities, but an important one is to hire and supervise the operation of the college, including the president. Page 7 runs through how we are funded. There are 3 major operating revenues for community colleges: state funds, property taxes, and tuition and fees. If you were to have looked at this chart in 1989-90 before the passage of Measure 5, you would have seen property tax at 50%, state funds at about 20 to 22%. So we have had a flip-flop over the last decade. Our general fund is making up more of the funding for students.
Where are the federal funds? They're not reflected in that chart, but yet, according to your first chart, you have $113 million in federal funds, $467 million in general fund. That would be more than 25%.
Mr. Chair, the other segment in this particular pie chart does include federal funds, but not all community colleges receive that $113 million in federal funds. That also goes to local community-based organizations, not just community colleges, for the workforce training. Yeah, the community colleges are rarely the sole recipient of that federal resource.
Sort of combined those, and we recently put the two together under the community colleges. Before they were separate, and those monies wouldn't have been part of the community.
Mr. Co-Chair, yes, that's exactly right. The state agency did merge the workforce training entity at the state level with community college. Page 8 is a look at tuition. Again, just as a reminder, the rates are set by local college boards. The state average yearly tuition for a full-time student is just under $2,000. It is almost a 150% increase in the last decade, and Oregon does have the second highest tuition in the western region for community colleges. Page 9 gives you a snapshot of our enrollment. This is for this past year, 2000-2001, of 403,000 students. That's headcount. That I was copying Chancellor Cox yesterday when he made the comment that the university system is not feeling any recession. They are over-enrolled. We are as well. Fall term, we're at 4.5 statewide. Some places like Portland Community College has an enrollment increase of 11.5%. So community colleges are certainly, our experience is that they are counter-cyclical to economic downturn. When the economy starts to suffer, and more people have opportunity and seek the education and skills training that they need. page 9 just gives you a snapshot of what the largest and smallest college looks like. Page 10 is a picture of our student demographics. It's of note to point out the age of community college students. They tend to be older. Average age is 37. And we have a healthy demographic minority mix as well. On page 11, talking about what programs, what does the actual program mix look like? And this, again, is a statewide picture. We take the 17 colleges and run an average. But we have seen lower division transfer increase slightly in the last several years. Adult basic skills is at 19%, remedial ed, English as a second language, and those kinds of courses fall into those categories. And this is a picture of the 96,000 full-time students that we talked about earlier in the presentation. On page 12, we want to highlight for you that although we are student-driven, we're also community and business-driven. Community colleges feel they do play a vital role in Oregon's economic recovery. Here are just a couple examples. Then we'll have a little more discussion from the Lane president about small business development centers. There's also a lot of customized and contracted training under the business and industry training services that all community colleges provide to their community. And jumping down to the last one, the workforce preparation programs, there have been something like 30,000 jobs lost in the last 18 months in Oregon. Many of those dislocated workers are finding their way in increasing numbers to community colleges to get the training they need to re-enter the economy, the labor pool. On page 13, it's a picture of how do we figure the cost of a student, expenditures per student. This is nationally reported information. The latest we have available is $98.99, but it shows that almost $5,000 a student, what goes in to make up the delivery. It's, I think, important to note that 53% of the cost of delivering a community college education is direct instruction.
Mr. Chair, we had a comment from Chancellor Cox, maybe I misunderstood, that the cost was about the same, whether they're in higher ed or the community college. That's not true. It's about half, right? Anybody know? 40-50%? Nobody knows?
Senator and members, I don't have those numbers offhand, but it is true that on average, the cost of educating students at community colleges is quite less than it is at higher ed. And it's important to note, of course, that the two types of institutions, while they overlap in providing coursework generally for the first 2 years of postgraduate degrees, the two institutions do provide very different types of services from each other. A large proportion of the people in community colleges are not in a preparation for a four-year program, and a large proportion of the funding that's used in higher education goes for research programs and graduate programs that wouldn't be duplicated at the community college level. But yes, the average cost of educating students in the two systems are lower for community colleges, and I can try to get more accurate.
I guess my exact question, and if you wouldn't mind, what does it cost for the first 2 years, the college portion of life? That's what I'm talking about. So I'm going to get a feel for what we mean. Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that makes it complicated, I think, but certainly possible to get those figures, but it complicates it is the fact that within higher education as well, some courses are much more expensive courses than other courses are. And if you average the expensive courses and the courses that are not so expensive together, you get a higher figure. Mm-hmm. but a lot of the courses that would be comparable courses that are taught in community colleges at the state system level cost about the same to administer. The cost of an English class is somewhat the same. The cost of a history class is somewhat the same, and so forth, for undergraduates.
Moving on page 14, this is a snapshot, again, of the legislatively approved budget not so very long ago of $467 million for the Community College Support Fund. State revenue is now approximately 46% of the 46% of the cost of the student. Page 15 begins to show you the actual impact of 2% reductions from the Community College Support Fund. It is $9.3 million. If we use this, our average cost per student, we will be affecting approximately 3,800 students. I want to make sure that you understand that we're not saying that they would not make their way, 3,800 students. That 3,800 students is an access question where they would be impacted at being able to take the classes that they wanted when they wanted in order to finish in a timely fashion. And as this percentage increase goes up, it becomes more and more likely that students would have access difficulty and would not be able to actually enroll. Page 16 is another more visual impact of the reductions. It shows the percent of reduction and number of students that would be affected. We are expecting to serve about 840,000 students during this biennium. You can see that we would drop that considerably with the full 10% reduction. And page 17, although in rather small print, this is a picture of exactly how each college will be affected with each 2% reduction. And I think it's important to note that Portland, being the largest post-secondary institution in the state, serving almost 100,000 students a year, will lose over $10 million for the full 10% reduction. And with that, setting the stage for what the reductions look like, I would like to yield the testimony table to President John Carnahan from Lynn Benton Community College, Gretchen Schutte, the president from Chemeketa Community College, and Mary Spielde, the president of Lane Community College.
Okay, any questions before we move to the presidents?
I'll stay close.
Thank you.
Co-chairs Trow and Byer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Carnahan. I'm the president of Lynn Benton Community College in Albany. We'd like to express our appreciation for your time this morning. We all recognize that
about Oregon State just a minute. The Oregon State University has grown by more than 4,000 students in the last 5 years. Think about what I just said, 4,000 students.
It is $9.3 million. If we use this, our average cost per student, we will be affecting approximately 3,800 students. I want to make sure that you understand that we're not saying that they would not make their way, 3,800 students. That 3,800 students is an access question where they would be impacted at being able to take the classes that they wanted when they wanted in order to finish in a timely fashion. And as this percentage increase goes up, it becomes more and more likely that students would have access difficulty and would not be able to actually enroll. Page 16 is another more visual impact of the reductions shows the percent of reduction and number of students that would be affected. We are expecting to serve about 840,000 students during this biennium. You see that we would drop that considerably with the full 10% reduction. And page 17, although in rather small print, this is a picture of exactly how each college will be affected with each 2% reduction. And I think it's important to note that Portland, being the largest post-secondary institution in the state, serving almost 100,000 students a year, will lose over $10 million for the full 10% reduction. And with that, setting the stage for what the reductions look like, I would like to yield the testimony table to President John Carnahan from Lynn Benton Community College, Gretchen Schutte, the president from Chemeketa Community College, and Mary Spielde, the president of Lane Community College.
Are there any questions before we move to the president?
I'll stay close.
Thank you.
Co-chairs Trowe and Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Carnahan. I'm the president of Lynn Benton Community College in Albany. We'd like to express our appreciation for your time this morning. We all recognize that this is a difficult time for our country and Oregon. We all know that community colleges cannot be held harmless to the economic conditions facing Oregon. However, we also want you to know that we're going to be a part of the solution to that problem. Historically, when the economy has taken a downturn, the demand for community college services has increased. Enrollment demands in Oregon's community colleges, as Commissioner Price Crowley indicated earlier, are up over 4% from a year ago, and are at the highest levels in the history of Oregon's community colleges. You add to the fact that most high school graduates now are selecting community colleges to start their college career, it doesn't look like that demand is going to change anytime soon. As you know, community colleges have a comprehensive mission providing opportunities for students who want to go on to four-year colleges, universities, and our transfer program, as well as our professional technical programs, as well as self-improvement or remedial type courses. And regardless of the programs that you look at, enrollment throughout Oregon's community colleges has grown, whether it's a transfer program or a professional technical program. And when I talk about things that happen at Lynn Benton Community College, I could be as well talking about what's happening at Chemeketa or Lane or any of the other 16 community colleges in Oregon. When I look at our transfer enrollment, we look at the partnerships that we have, for example, with Oregon State University. We currently have over 1,100 students that are dual enrolled between Lynn Benton Community College and Oregon State University. When I look at our programs, whether they're engineering, whether they're business, whether they're math, whether they're science, over the last 3 years, they've grown anywhere from 20 to 30% in all of those programs. As you know, we also offer partnerships with K-12. I look at our dual enrolled students for K-12. We have over 550 students currently enrolled from our local public schools that are enrolled during the day in the school district as well as in the community college. So regardless of the program that you look at, you're looking at growth opportunities for Oregonians. When tuition went up, we talked about that earlier in the early 1990s, I heard the discussion with higher ed and did it for students at community college. I think it did, although I think President Frommeyer was correct and some students just didn't go to college. But the fact is a lot of them found their ways to community colleges, and you would assume that our transfer enrollment would grow at a greater rate than our professional technical enrollment. And that's one of the things that we try to protect against as a comprehensive college. It would be really easy, given times like this, for us to become junior colleges, provide the less expensive way when you have a classroom of 35 chairs and one faculty member rather than the capital investment in a professional technical program. But when you look at our professional technical programs across the board, whether they're manufacturing or agriculture or health sciences, they're growing almost at the same level that the transfer programs are growing. And generally, that's when the economy is good, and that's over the last 3 or 4 years. And so if you add the dimension of an economy now that's slowing. And in Linn County, you look at Hewlett-Packard laying off over 400 individuals this summer. You look at Ormet laying off 80 employees last spring. Advanced Wood Products in Brownsville laying off 38. ATS in Corvallis laying off 35. You have over 600 employees on strike at Teledyne Huaqiang. Obviously, the economy is suffering, and we have a number of unemployed individuals in our community that are going to be seeking education, training, and retraining. And that's how and why the community colleges can be a part of the solution to the problem that we're facing today. In addition to the more traditional programs in college transfer areas and professional technical, we do a lot of work, and I'm sure that President Spilvey and President Schutte will be talking about some of the specific programs that we have. But we do a lot of work in training and retraining and short-term training. For example, Linn Benton Community College has developed several programs just in the last year that are short-term training opportunities for people who can come in, get a skill, and find employment in pharmaceutical technology, in veterinary technology, in phlebotomy, where they don't have to go to the traditional year or two-year programs. And so we're involved with business and industry as partners, as well as the K-12 and higher education partners. I know President Spilvey will talk about small business development and our involvement in economic development in our communities. We're all involved in the economic development of creating jobs and bringing industries to our communities. Recently in Albany, First Consumer National Bank, which is a call service, opened a business in Albany employing over 400 individuals at over $11 an hour. And they located in Albany because Linn Benton Community College could provide the training for those 400 employees. So we are involved in economic development. Last night, as I was reading my local newspaper, the local Albany Democrat Herald, there was a small article that talks about some job categories are short on candidates. The demand exceeds supply for certain job categories in Linn County. Currently, the Oregon Employment Department, auto mechanics, diesel mechanics, heating, ventilation, air conditioning mechanics, machinists and training and experience and employers require are in short supply. Long-haul truckers, certified nursing assistants, convenience store cashiers, welders, and fabricators. Linn Benton Community College offers a program in each one of those areas where there's a shortage of employees, and we don't have a shortage of people that are looking for jobs at the last we've had in the community, so community colleges will be part of the solution. What does that mean to Linn Benton Community College as it relates to a budget impact? Quickly, if there's a 2% reduction for Linn Benton Community College, it would mean about $660,000 in the biennium, and we are currently in the process of trying to reduce our budget by $660,000. I put a freeze on hiring, limited spending in order to reserve some of our resources as we go into the next budget year. At a 6% reduction, we're talking about $1.9 million reduction. When we get to 4 to 6%, we're talking about having a dramatic impact on the number of students we serve and the programs that we offer. A 4% or a 6% reduction would affect about 500 full-time equivalent students, or over 2,000 individuals that currently have opportunities at Linn Benton Community College. A 10% reduction is about $3 million, 850 FTE, and about 3,500 individuals. We currently enroll over 27,000 students a year, which is actually more than Oregon State enrolls in headcount in any given year. I was here in 1982. I was here more than once in 1982. We were facing similar problems with the economy and recession. And we were coming to you with state support of, as Commissioner Percy Brawley said, of between 20 and 25%. And so we were making reductions of 2, 4, 6, 8% of 20 to 25% of the resources that community colleges received. And the difference between 1982 and today is that once we made it, we went back out to our communities. We talked to our local communities, and we said, here's the impact that those state reductions will have on your community college. And so you need to help us decide what Linn Benton Community College will look like. And they did that through an increased tax base or a serial levy, where they had the opportunity to help us make decisions to form the programs and services that they wanted in a local community. Today, those options are gone, and the decisions will basically be up to you and to our local boards in making the decisions on the reductions that we're going to have to make. We want you to know that Oregon's community colleges can lead a charge for the economic recovery if you give us that opportunity. Thank you very much.
Co-chairs Byron, Troa, and members of the committee, I'm Gretchen Schutte, for the record, president of Chemeketa Community College. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and speak with you. I have two topics to speak on briefly. One is some of the services that Chemeketa has been focusing on in this economic downturn to be part of the economic recovery, and also the impact of potential cuts and also the process that Chemeketa would use to decide what to cut in the event of a reduction in state funding. Certainly want to begin by recognizing that there has been, as has already been said, an impact from the recession on the demand that Chemeketa is feeling for its services, and talk a bit about our response to that demand and how it's part of what Chemeketa is doing to help Oregon's economy. I know that when community colleges met with you all during the session, specific commitments were outlined to you to be accessible, affordable, adaptable, and accountable, and the colleges have truly responded to those commitments. Chemeketa folks had been meeting recently with legislators to thank them for past support, but also to present our accountability report, and I think that has been distributed to you, and other copies are available. Among the things that it shows is that Chemeketa has been truly successful. Last year, we served one in about every six adults in the three-county district, over 58,000 people. We certainly have increased opportunities for students to both take college courses, but also to receive training that contributes to those individuals' ability to contribute to the economy. I'm a new president. I started in July, and coming to that from work both in the university sector and in K through 12, and coming back into community college, I have not just been surprised, but been truly amazed by the development of the workforce training effort of Oregon's community colleges, and that's what I want to focus on today. Certainly in our three-county district, Marion, Polk, Yamhill County, the slowdown in regional recruitment and business expansion that's been nationwide is certainly there in our district. We have a very high unemployment rate. Just looking at figures on October 11th, job listings for the three-county area were down 15% to 20%. We've been keeping track to the extent that we can of layoffs between January 2000 and October, 1,375 full-time manufacturing jobs at 18 firms in Marion and Polk County were reported, and that doesn't count the temporary part-time help that was impacted as well. And then, in addition, we saw 1,017 layoffs at 11 retail firms, and this is just in our district. Yesterday, I asked for an update in this arena and some of the kinds of figures that President Carnahan was sharing. We have also in our district 400 temporary layoffs in the Newburgh area, 95 permanent layoffs in the Yamhill area, an additional 200 to 300 layoffs in the Salem area, and again, impact in temporary layoffs in the AgriProsen closure. And you know that closure was the largest in the last 5 years as far as employee layoffs, permanent layoffs. In the Dallas Polk County area, the Tyco layoff that just came up is the latest, and that affects over 130 employees. So that's the picture that we are trying to address. We've had a continuing response. Over 1,300 dislocated workers from 21 businesses in the district have received services over about the last year and a half as we've tried to respond with our partners to this impact. And more knock on the door every day. We're seeing thousands of laid-off workers, and we want to help them all. And currently, we don't have the resources to serve all of them. Just to give a little bit of a picture of how we do this, we contact the business, and provided they're willing to work with us, we get to the site as soon as possible. We work with economic development partners to try to identify any options that there might be to keep the business open. If that isn't feasible, we try to provide information to the employers about unemployment insurance, our services, and then for the workers, we provide orientation services on site in many cases. We make sure that workers are aware of services that are available through the Job and Career Centers. There are seven in our district. We conduct an assessment of the workers' skills, language background, experience, education, and help develop a plan for reemployment. And we have had some federal resources to work on this, the WIA funds, but Schmeckett is also contributing in program development, delivery, infrastructure. For example, we've provided a computer network lab for the Woodburn Transition Center that was set up just for initially the agribusiness employees, and really worked in many arenas with basic literacy, as well as English language assistance and job retraining and other services. And then Schumacher employees have taken the initiative to seek out additional resources. We received a U.S. Department of Ed grant, and through that we'll establish a community technology center that will allow us to continue some of the services and also provide some new services for those who lost jobs and those who may lose jobs in the future. So my main message is that we would like to continue to support the economic recovery of the region. We want to serve both the local businesses and the people. And we have made a commitment and emphasized that during the past legislative session that we would develop workforce programs that respond in new ways to focus on the needs of business and industry. At some of the centers, the job and career centers I mentioned, we're seeing as many as 400 clients a day, from former farm workers, factory workers, to dot-com employees and employers. And certainly our ability to serve in this way would be impacted by reduction. I do want to mention that, of course, not everything we do is related to an economic downturn. Not every industry is a downturn, and we work with regional businesses and industry partners, government, community agencies to work on current workforce training and retraining. Last year, for example, Schmeckett held over 600 classes, served over 10,500 people with customized training, whether on our own campus or at the employer site. So that just highlights of the kind of effort that Oregon's community colleges are doing in this arena. Specifically, what would budget cuts mean to Schmeckett? We are a very much participative decision-making organization, and we are right now looking hard at how to achieve significant cuts and exactly where we would cut. I did bring along copies for you of the guiding principles for our process, and staff is working right now, as I speak, to look at what would be the impact of this shortfall and of significant cuts both in the current budget. We're looking to adjust there, of course, but also in next year's budget. And as you can see from the guiding principles, we'll hold students as our highest priority. We'll try to keep our commitment to access and also to quality education and training. We know a lot about current demand and future demand. We will certainly use that information as we look at reductions, and we have 10-year trend data on FTE and cost for FTE, and we will use that information as well. But despite efforts to minimize loss of access, we do estimate that a 1% reduction in full-time equivalent students would occur for every 1% reduction in funding. So more than likely, a 2% funding reduction would translate into 250 FTE lost or 1,250 individual students impacted. And that's because we don't have excess capacity. This fall, we had 405 closed sections in subject areas such as English as a second language, computer science, speech, art, foreign language, English, social science, physical science, life science, and mathematics.
Thank you. We need to move on. Do we have anything additional to add from Lane County? And I think we've heard a good background on community colleges in general and all your program areas you serve. Do you have anything additional you can give us from specifically on Lane Community College?
Senators Beyer and Tro, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Spilde. I'm president at Lane Community College. And let me just speak briefly about the impacts of cuts at Lane Community College.
I want to hear about those impacts because it did seem as though, especially with Temecula Community College, the presentation, we didn't get enough specifics, so we don't have a good idea of how you're going to manage cuts that may for Temecula be as much, if we have to go upwards of $4 to $6 million. And you know, I just didn't get any good understanding of how you're going to handle that.
Well, at Lane, like the other community colleges, we're committed to being part of the solution. We want to be flexible and responsive, and we're committed to working with our communities to meet the need. However, next year at Lane, regardless of what the state does with budget cuts, we will be cutting close to $7 million from our budget, which is about 9% of our budget.
Ms. Chair, you're already cutting that much?
Yes, we are.
Why is that?
We've been cutting about $1 million every year for the last 5 years, and while we've been continuing to grow, and we've been using reserves and one-time money to try and to continue to meet the demand of our community. And we're at the point now where we don't have the reserves. We're spending more than we're bringing in, and like the state and like every individual, we have to balance our budget. So we will be making very major cuts in the next year. We've been serving more students without additional resources for the past 5 years, and there's a point at which you just can't do that anymore, and Lane is at that point. The way we're approaching this, we've started a review of everything that we do. We've developed budget principles, and we've developed criteria for every component of our offerings for professional technical programs, transfer, remedial, personal enrichment. We have different sets of criteria for each of those components. Our departments are now applying those criteria to every single thing that they do, and as soon as they have those recommendations, which will be about the middle of January, we'll have staff committees looking at those recommendations and making final recommendations in about the middle of February for the cuts that we will make. There is no doubt that we will eliminate programs and services. We will have to eliminate some professional technical programs, transfer. We're also looking at efficiencies. We have been streamlining our work for the past 5 years. At Lane, we don't think there's anywhere to go there, but we'll continue to try to be more efficient. Simultaneously, we're looking at tuition and fee increases, but to offset our budget shortfall before any state cuts, we would have to increase tuition by $20 per credit, which for sure is going to limit access to students, and many students who already cannot afford to attend post-secondary education. We're making the best of the situation at Lane. We know that when we get through this situation, 90% of what we do will still be there. But we're not going to continue to thin the soup. We're going to make sure that whatever we do, it will be of reasonable quality. Although smaller, we plan to be more focused and to provide the necessary resources to provide quality in the things that we do. The downside of all of this, of course, is that fewer students are going to be served, and they're going to have fewer choices in Lane County to do the things that they want to do and to pursue the careers that they want to do. And any further reductions in the state beyond the 2% that we've already taken, which is included in this $6.7 million, will of course make the situation even worse. A 10% cut for Lane is about $6 million over the biennium. So that would be, you know, double what we're already planning to do. So we're in this situation, and we're working very hard to get out of it, and we think we can stabilize the budget over time, but we want to continue to be part of the economic recovery, and Lane has been refocusing our efforts in that regard. We're reorganizing to bring more focus to our business development, workforce development, and economic development activities. We're also looking at our business development, and if I could just say a word about business development centers statewide, because I do think they're an important part of economic recovery. Lane hosts the Oregon Small Business Development Center Network for the whole state, and in that role, we receive the federal funds and distribute them. We monitor performance goals for all the SBDCs in the state, and we're currently working with the Community and Economic Development Department at the state level to look at doing that same thing for the state, so again, that can be streamlined. And let me just give you a couple of facts about the network of small business centers. They provide assistance and counseling to small businesses. Last year, 2000, this is on an annual survey, we counseled 6,201 business owners. The Oregon SBDC clients created 3,322 new jobs in 2000 alone. 2,043 of those were rural jobs with an average payroll of 22,772. In the urban areas, the payroll was $30,912. The funding for this, about 900,000 comes from the federal government, 940 some from the state, but over 2 million from the local community colleges. By far, the community colleges put most of the money into this effort to create these jobs. We want to continue to contribute funding at this level, but obviously we're going to have to look at everything that we do as we deal with the state budget cuts and the local cuts. Just at the time when SBDCs are receiving more demand from unemployed or underemployed people who are saying, well, maybe this is the time to pursue my dream of starting a business, we're going to have to look at balancing this with all the other things that we may have to cut. So we want to be part of the solution. We want to help you make these very difficult choices. But in order to do that, we need some help from you to stabilize. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Yee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess you know our focus is to maintain instruction, quality instruction, and streamline administration and improve efficiency. So I want to know, what is your, the panel's, the presidents of colleges' reaction to combining the administration of college, community colleges with higher ed? Because higher ed already supervises the four college grades, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, and I believe that it would be very efficient to administer the college boards also with the same board and not have a separate board to administer community colleges, workforce development. Seems to me workforce development would belong to employment division. So is there any efficiency we can gain and savings we can gain from combining the two? What is the budget for the board for community colleges?
Co-chair is Tron Byron, mm-hmm. versus committee. Senator Yee, as you know, the State Board of Education is the controlling state board for Oregon's community colleges. There's not a separate state board for community colleges. Community colleges were founded by local communities. The enacting legislation to create community colleges is the one that allowed communities to create them, are managed and governed by elected local boards. And we spend a half a day a month with the State Board of Education in a special session dealing with policy issues from the state. And so there have been a number of studies over the years to create one super board, to divide the boards, have three boards. I think our conclusion has been that we're about efficient as we can be organized currently. I don't think we support three boards currently. There are two: State Board of Education for K-12 and community colleges, and State Board of Higher Education.
Or maybe, Mr. Chairman, maybe you combine it with the State Board of Education. I think combining it with Board of Higher Ed makes no sense, because they are managing the first and second, the freshman and sophomore year anyway. I think there's a lot of advantage in combining the two and save $2.1 million.
I don't know how you'd save $2.1 million, but I think you'd have to deal with the local, it really becomes a governance issue. And the state system of higher education is basically supported by the state of Oregon. The Oregon's community colleges, at least, are still somewhat supported by local communities. And two: State Board of Education for K-12 and community colleges, and the State Board of Higher Education.
Or maybe, Mr. Chairman, maybe you combine it with the State Board of Education. I think combining it with Board of Higher Ed makes no sense, because they are managing the first and second, the freshman and sophomore year anyway. I think there's a lot of advantage in combining the two and save $2.1 million.
I don't know how you'd save $2.1 million, but you'd have to deal with the local, it becomes a government, it really becomes a governance issue. And the state system of higher education is basically supported by the state of Oregon. The Oregon's community colleges, at least, are still somewhat supported by local communities. And we just don't see that duplication.
Okay. Any questions?
You can respond in writing, give us a more careful analysis. Why would the merging of the two boards not be beneficial? I see a lot of duplication.
The legislature makes us a decision. There are all these political entities sitting right up here with you, but you might want to phrase that question.
Well, we'll ask for a response in writing to Senator Yee's request. Any other questions of the community colleges at this time? I do have one. I would like to respond in your cuts is defined in your program area. They do not see any reduction of administration in any of the program areas that the administration that would go with programs, and also in your admin cuts, I didn't see any actual cuts or fund shifts from general funds to federal funds, and I think that in the direction the governor's office was given to all agencies, it was not fund shifts, but actual reductions in administration. And I don't think you've actually, unless I'm missing something, but in your admin list, I see, and even, I don't want to take time now to go over it individually, but I just like you to take a look and see if it truly is all just fund shifts. I don't think that meets the mark of the governor's office directing of the agency. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We will now move to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and we are scheduled for lunch break at 12:30. Obviously, we're going to be running a little long. I'd like to be done by 12:45. That gives us about 25 minutes with Student Assistance Commission, and I apologize, we're going to take about 5 minutes off your time schedule, but that way we have a chance to get back on target for this afternoon also. So we're going to shorten our lunch by 15 minutes too. Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon, co-chairs. Good afternoon, co-chairs, Trill and Byerson, members of the committee. I'm Jeff Sweetser, the Executive Director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and with me is Ryan Clem, Vice Chair of the Oregon Student Association Assistance Commission. Commission. We are handing out a template in which we're going to follow a conversation. But before I get into talking about the reductions, I wanted to talk briefly about the environment in which we discussed how to identify budget reductions as a part of this process. And the first bullet that you have there is how we help over 50,000 Oregon college students each year. We accomplish this through three student financial aid programs. The first is through scholarships. Our agency administers over 200 private scholarships for donors who have contacted us to provide student aid to Oregon students. We will deliver over $8.5 million to over 3,000 students through these privately funded scholarships. The second area of student financial aid that we provide is through student loans. Our agency is the guarantor for the Federal Family Education Loan Program. And finally, we also deliver the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which many of you are familiar with. The Oregon Opportunity Grant represents over 95% of the funding that we receive from the Oregon Legislature in general funds and lottery funds. I believe that the significance of both the lottery funds and general funds really helps focus this conversation, and it focused our conversation among the commissioners as well. But this conversation is really about the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. Briefly, I want to talk about our current situation, Oregon's. You've heard from both OUS and the community colleges about their increasing enrollment. We heard from one of the OUS presidents that their enrollment increased by over 4,000 students in 5 years. We heard about a 4% increase in community colleges enrollment this last year.
our unemployment increases in a time of recession. State revenues are declining. We are impacted in lottery fund earnings as well. And what that leads us to is what I describe as a triple whammy. The proposed cuts in general funds impact the opportunity grant program, and they set off a ripple effect that first starts with students. Students would not be able to access post-secondary education as a result of reduced funding. And in the reduction options, you'll see that there are roughly 780 students that would not get an opportunity grant for every 2% reduction in the budget that we have for opportunity grants. The second ripple effect is the other state entities. You heard quite eloquently from the two previous meetings about the impact on both OUS and community colleges. We deliver paid students who then take it to colleges and the OUSs. So reductions in OUS and community college budgets will be affected by their direct cuts, but they'll also be impacted by the lower student aid that their students are bringing to their campuses. And last, there's the impact on the Oregon economy. Lack of education leads to Oregonians not having an opportunity for advanced training and resultant lack of opportunity to compete for better jobs and industries in Oregon. There's also other broader impacts. The one that comes to mind is the tax revenues, and we heard in the previous OUS testimony about the value of a college education and what kind of revenue that brings to the state as far as income taxes. In conclusion, I want to say that we focus not only on the impact on a student and whether or not they get an opportunity grant. By doing so, we would miss the multiplier effect of an investment in higher education. We believe that every dollar invested by this legislature in funding the opportunity grant is a dollar well spent. The chart I'm going to step through very briefly, and as I indicated, over 95% of our funding is in the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The first 2% is opportunity grant reductions. The second 2% is a combination of opportunity grants to students as well as reductions in nursing services, rural health loan repayment program, and a former foster youth scholarship program. The third, fourth, and fifth reductions are all opportunity grant awards to students. The other point that I would make is in the third 2% reduction, we would experience some loss of federal funds that we receive as a match with the Oregon Opportunity Grant. I would, in the interest of time, I'd like to turn it over to our vice chair and have him talk about what the commission went through in coming up with these reductions.
Thank you, Senators. My name is Brian Clem, and I'm the Vice Chair of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. I reside in Salem, and part of the year in Parkdale, Oregon. I own a computer company here in Salem, and we're co-owners of our family orchard where we grow apples and pears in Parkdale. And I'm on the commission because I got a NEED grant 10 years ago when I went to school, and it helped me go to college and eventually become an employer. And between the two companies that I operate, along with the family, we employ 20 to 25 people at different times of the year. And it's important to our commission, who are all volunteers and citizens, that we provide you with real, meaningful options if you need to make reductions. And so we tried to outline real specifically how many people would not get their shot at a NEED grant, or how many people would not get a loan incentive program to go practice in rural Oregon. And we try to be real clear for them. We don't envy your job, and you'll never be paid enough to have to make these kind of decisions. But in coming up with these options, we try to use three principles in outlining options for you. One is to serve as many citizens as possible and still do it in a meaningful way. And by that, I mean not reduce the grants by so much per person that it basically doesn't help them make that decision to go ahead and go to college, because it's only $400 or $500, and that would have been one way to look at it. Another is to focus on our mission, which is to help students finance their way through college. And we have a couple programs that you'll notice in the second tier that are really loan repayment programs. They're not to get you through. They're to serve other purposes. The last is to honor the commitments we've already made in this biennium. And we had dispersed some monies already to some of these former foster children to help them get started. And we didn't want to go back and sort of renege on that 40% that we had already given out. So we ask that we maintain at least that level of funding. The real life effect of these options that we're outlining for you are that 16 rural communities who have documented critical health care shortages may not get that incentive program from the state to lure a doctor out there for 5 years to help practice. The 20 former foster children will not get the help from the state to pay for college. And the legislature just funded this, and the theory behind it was that the state had taken control of their lives for a good reason at a young age, and now the state's going to help them go to college the way a normal parent might do so. Last, the opportunity grant, 7,600 Oregon scholarships would not be given to students who truly need some help in order to go to college. That's at a 10% cut. And those students go to places like Clackamas and Central Oregon Community College and Reed and Southern Oregon and University of Portland, basically all sectors of our post-educational offerings here in Oregon. So to summarize, a 2% cut would mean that about 780 people and 1,400 grants would not go out. Above that, we risk losing some matching federal funds, and it also has a drastic impact on some of these other programs like the nursing loan repayment program, the rural health doctor, and the former foster children scholarships. We, of course, would not like to have any cuts, but I guess everybody would like that. So we're here to give you options and to answer questions about what these would mean.
Thank you, Senator Harper. Before we get to your question, Steve, I've got a question. On the paper that was just handed out, they're showing 1,400 fewer grants at the first 2% level, but in the booklet you provided for us, you have down 780 fewer grants for the same dollar amount. There seems to be a 100% discrepancy there.
Yes, Senator. The difference is that the material that the commission prepared and submitted to you refers to what they call the number of grants that are awarded, and we were trying to put in numbers of grants that are actually received. What happens is the commission awards far more grants that are actually paid out because they know that a large number of people who receive the grants don't end up using them. They don't attend college at the to the extent that's necessary to be eligible for the award. So we feel that the numbers that we've used here, and we are still working with the commission to get these numbers down as best as we can, represents the actual number of students who will not receive money because of the reduction.
So it's, by the numbers I see, it's roughly 50% of the people who receive a grant award don't actually use
yeah,
them.
About that, yes.
I take it they don't get the money then?
No, they do not get the money.
So do the 50% that get the money get twice as much?
No. The what the commission does is the commission knows how many awards can actually be paid out, given the amount of money that's available and the size of the award. They then essentially extend offers for the opportunity grant to far more people and they can afford to pay it, sort of like the airlines, you know, overbooking flights or that sort of thing, because they know that a certain percentage will not accept the award.
So the $890,000 for 2% actually funds 780 grants, not 1,400 grants?
Yes. And if you do the division, it's about, I think I was using about $1,300. Maybe it was less. I have to look at that number again as how much people who actually receive the grants on average receive from the grant.
You have, in both cases, you have down what the is written grant awards that may be more accurately reflected if in, would we put grants received over here in the booklet and grants awarded in the paper that we just handed out.
Thank you.
I think that would make it clear.
Co-Chair Byer, if I might respond to that. At the time that we make an award to student, we don't know whether what their intentions are. They may be only going half-time and not qualify. You have to be full-time in order to receive the opportunity grant. They may choose to go out of state, or because of lack of adequate financial resources from all sources, it may not be enough for them to make the decision to go to college. So at the time that we make the award, we don't know what their ultimate decision is. And it's a filtering process. Steve's analysis is based upon number of recipients, and when you do the math, it makes more sense in that respect. But it's a continuing conversation we have among ourselves and also with the legislature about how best to present this information. And if, in fact, we had a fully funded opportunity grant, we might see more students, a higher percentage of students actually picking up their opportunity grant. And right now it's about 59% of all awards that we make actually get picked up, or students actually receive money.
Okay. Well, that might answer a little piece of my question, but your numbers, I count, at the 10% level, you'll give out 6,179 less grants, but you'll only decrease your FTEs by a tenth of a person.
I appreciate Co-Chairs and Senator Harper and members of the committee. I appreciate that question. We had that yesterday. The information that's being presented here today is program reductions, and as a result of this program reduction, we have two-tenths of an FTE associated with Rural Health Services. That individual is responsible for collecting on loans when the recipients do not fulfill their obligation. We also went through a similar exercise on administrative reductions, and there was that is a separate conversation. We had identified about $66,000 out of our budget for administrative reductions, and we haven't identified any FTE at this stage, but there's about five, the equivalent of five FTE in our agency of 90-some employees that are funded with general funds. So if we get to a 10% cut in administrative and program, we would experience some reductions in staff. We haven't gone to that level of identifying who and what those positions would be. What we're looking at here is program reductions.
How many grants do you do a year?
Opportunity grants, we have about 19,000.
19,000.
Did I hear you correctly say you have 90 FTE in your agency of general fund?
No, sir. We have over 90 employees, and about five of the FTE are general funded. It's a composite, like my position has some general fund and some other funds.
Do you always use all the money that's appropriated for the student need grant or the opportunity grant? Do you use that funding so that money is used and it goes to students who need it? A lot more apply for it than get it simply because there's not enough money to go around. Is that the way it works?
Co-Chair and Senator Crow, members of the committee, yes. In fact, we at times have overspent because of this award process where we don't know what they're going to be doing. We spend all of the money that we have available. In this last legislative session, we actually went to the E-Board because we had overextended ourselves by a little bit, and we had some additional interest earnings in the Educational Endowment Fund, and we're able to cover the shortfall. But even with using all of the funds that we have available, we still are only serving about 75% of the eligible students in the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. Yes, we use it all.
Rather than to cut so drastically the grants, why not try capping them or something of that nature so that more students can come and have access to higher education?
That is a question that the commission has continuously struggled with, and to
could speak to it, Hillary.
But briefly, in talking about access, in order to be able to go to school, students need to feel like they have sufficient resources in order to cover the cost of education. And if you were to reduce the Oregon Opportunity Grant to $500 or by some number, it begins to marginalize not only the program, but that student's ability to access education. If it costs $10,000 and I only have $5,000 available, I'm not going to be going to college.
So you'd rather serve fewer with a greater opportunity than to serve more who are barely making it. Is that...
Senator, if I could answer, Mr. Chair, what we struggle with this every time as a commission. We talk about it, and we try and make it a level so it's an incentive to actually go to college. So if you're looking at your little financial aid letter that's come, and you see that you've got a $1,500 grant to help along with maybe some other programs, there's a psychological calculation that takes place in the parents and students' mind compared to a $500 grant. And so what we've chosen to do over the last 20 years is base our formula on trying to maintain something that actually gives you an incentive to go. And so, you know, that's the theory, and you could do it the other way. I just don't know how effective it would be, and we've been under the impression that it would be better to help some and help less people, but help them to a greater degree. In fact, we've even talked about going further and helping even less people, the truly needy, who are you know, way down the median income scale to 25 or 30% rather than 75%, and really help them more. But it's a difficult calculation to make.
Thank you. I can appreciate that.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Enjoy your lunch.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing us back on time, almost. Appreciate that. With that, we will recess until 1:30. We will be back and start in on natural resource thing on time. Agenda this afternoon, so we're going to take right off, and as other people show up, hopefully they won't interrupt too much. Lindsay, you want to start? Fish and Wildlife Department.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and with me today is Deputy Director Pam Ryan of the Administrative Services side of the agency. The packet that you have before you today is a document that we prepared as a result of 10% reductions in general fund and lottery funds in the Department of Fish and Wildlife. They're identified in 2% increments. And also, in addition to that, we were asked to attach a sheet that identified 3 hatcheries that would be closed as well. As we went through this process, we looked at the 2 statutes for the Department of Fish and Wildlife that with respect to the wildlife policy, ORS 496-102, and the food fish policy, ORS 506.109. Those 2 policies are the principal statutes that guide this agency with respect to fish and wildlife management and utilization. In addition, we referenced the Oregon benchmarks, and we also looked at the 4 priorities that we identified, that the leadership team identified for the agency earlier this year. That was restoring fiscal integrity of the agency, implementation of the native fish conservation and fish propagation policies, comprehensive review of our wildlife damage policy, and also integrating the Oregon plan into ODFW's work priorities. The first budget cut that we worked through was the administration cut of 10%. These are classified as a temporary cut, totaling $256,537. The executive assistant to the director was eliminated for the first and second year, as was the administrative specialist in the information education division and the publications editor for the wildlife division. Again, that accrued a savings of $256,537.
After that, we looked at...
Senator Trow. Consequences of those administrative cuts, what does that do to you or for you?
With respect to the supervisor, executive assistant, and the director's office, there were originally four support people in that office. We had cut one of those four, and we are cutting the second one, leaving us two in the director's office that provide support to the commission, the director, and the two deputies, and also goes through the administrative rules processes. What it does is we take support time away from the seven commissioners, and we drive that down into the staff in the different divisions. We still have to respond to the public, we still have to go through the administrative rules, and we still have to perform the duties for the commission meetings and the commission meeting notes.
So will that result in a lowering of the quality of the administrative service?
It will, but it will, and it will also drive work into the divisions.
Okay. Are they already overworked?
In my estimation, they are.
Yes, you said.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
We then looked at program cuts, the second assignment. The program cuts are permanent. As we roll into the 03-05 biennium, these cuts will not be restored. We looked at 2%, 4%, and for the most part, at those two levels, you will not see the elimination of a position that is filled. There are a couple positions at the 4% level where we have people occupying positions that will be eliminated. When you get into the 6% cuts, you're going to find that you will eliminate jobs that are occupied. And when you work your way through to the fifth 2% level, the total is an elimination of 31 positions. About half of those are filled.
And, Mr. Chair, what consequences will those bring to the department, getting rid of those people? Are they superfluous? Do you not need them?
Chair Beyer, Senator Trow, the consequences are varied. For instance, we would lose the fish geneticist for the agency. And, of course, the wild versus hatchery issue is very important with respect to the Endangered Species Act. Even though the Hogan decision came out, we're still having to work with genetic issues. In our hatchery management programs, we also are looking at how we can maintain genetic specificity for that specific fish run, but yet add this genetic diversity we need in our hatchery programs so that we don't experience domestication of our hatchery stocks and we maintain that high performance that we find necessary in our fish runs to be successful. So the fish geneticist is an important part. When you start getting into that level of cuts, you're just, you know, which knife cut's going to hurt the worst. For instance, again,
Lindsay, could you put that in perspective out of the 15 layoff, 31 FTE positions out of a staff of how many?
There's a staff in the Department of Fish and Wildlife of about 1,200 people total.
Is that FTE or is that people, that body?
That's people.
Okay.
And